Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, let me thank the Society of the Humanities at Boston University for the kind invitation. And I'm very happy to be here, and I have already learned a lot. And before actually engaging fully into the discussion about the Digital Archive of Chinese Studies, let me perhaps bring up a point which might be interesting for the broader discussion. There is something like a dark horse in the room, which is an unnamed gentleman, which happens to be the state. So we have been talking about the problem of technical archiving, namely question of different generations of archival records, which are difficult to transfer, and we have in our wonderful Heidelberg center of the internet technology, we have something like, well, perhaps 5,000 digital tapes and soft floppies and so on and so forth, which are illegible today. So this is obviously something that is real. The second is that we have a discussion about the question of business monopolies, namely business enterprises monopolizing research basically substantially funded by the state or foundations or the universities themselves, and that becomes then property of the digital providers like Elsevier and others, and that becomes then an exclusionary thing where you have what theoretically could be a flat earth of accessibility to digital resources ends up to reproduce hierarchies which are all too well known. But the third candidate in here, as a matter of fact, is the state. Now, a discussion in the United States might be forgiven of not mentioning the state as being essentially irrelevant, and very little of the discussion here has been addressed to it, but I'm not so quite sure whether that is, as a matter of fact, even true for the United States, but I will not deal with that. I mean, you saw the recent discussions in the federal government here about funding of the National Education of Humanities and so on and so forth, which obviously have a substantial impact on the question of archival presentation. And Professor Henderson this morning was mentioning that is there a master plan, as a matter of fact, for maintaining all these trillions of different formats and forums and archives and so on and so forth, which would guarantee that they survive over the next, I mean, even 10 or 20 years, you know? And obviously there isn't, you know? And that somehow looks as if there is another dark horse marching to the room, namely that that might be something like the state could be basically responsible for, to say, okay, this is a kind of a Library of Congress type of national responsibility to make sure that that is maintained. But the state comes in just not just as the kind of possible conserver of memory or something like that, but it is starts off, as a matter of fact, especially the nation state, its more recent incorporation since the early 19th century, as the administrator of memory. Namely, the state, nation state, basically takes on the responsibility that this memory and this history is ours, and therefore what's in, what is out, is what we determine. And that is a rather rigid form, which might, as a matter of fact, take on, you know, something like rather brutal forms, let's say the traditional Chinese state in imperial times, you know, a new dynasty came in. They would set down historians to write the history of the previous dynasty and then destroy the archive. That's just how you do it, you know. And that means that basically the administration of memory means that you don't only fill the books and the memory with the orthodox, one and only true history of what happened, you know, but you eliminate the options of thinking the alternative, you know, down to, you know, hiding it in some kind of little private writing or sort of accidentally preserved little tidbit of a diary or something like that. So the streamlining of memory comes in two parts. It comes, number one, in a censorship part, namely deleting those elements or letting them rot, you know, which don't fit the narrative. And number two, filling the airwaves or bookshelves or whatever you have, school records, you know, with what you want the authority, the one and only true history to be. And we have the linkage between that and technology, as a matter of fact, is not as loose as you may think. Now, you all are familiar with one of the main archival sources for things which are not the great and famous and printed and officially preserved authors, but the common folk or people who might not have made it into that rank because they were dissident or something like that. There is one of the big historical archives is, of course, the police archives. And now we have the wonderful best link for that, of course, in East Germany, where you had, you know, something like, well, 11% of the adult population being informal cooperators with the state security. And the state security was part, of course, of the technological development in East Germany, which in the Eastern Bloc was certainly in many areas most advanced, so they built their own computers. So the East German computers, you know, have then fallen by the roadside in 89 with the unification of Germany, with the effect that, as a matter of fact, functional East German computers of this brand used by the state security were at that moment at the total number of 5. The computers have a short lifespan, you know, so they start falling apart. And the problem is that the digital records of, we have always been talking about there being print records and digital records, you know, and the question of preserving the book records and so on and so forth. That's very nice. But you have now moved into a situation where a very large amount of records are digital originally. You might print them out, perhaps, you know, so the physical form, you know, is secondary to the digital form, you know. So now the East German secret police archives are all digital. Now the problem without these damn computers, you know, you cannot access them. And that means that, you know, I mean, there is a range of, you're talking 10% of the adult population being somehow in there, quite a part of all those who are on the record as being observed, you know, even that includes a lot of Westerners like myself, right? So you have a very pleasant record there. And now they are moving over into sort of taking one of the survivors as the spare part, organ donor in a way for the other survivor to keep this damn single computer running. Now at the problem they're down at 1 because they are not produced anymore and nobody has the money to produce them. So that one computer gets runs out of spare parts from the others, you know, you will have one of the largest archives of the actual social history of East Germany, you know, disappearing from the surface of the earth, you know. Here you have, you know, very nice kind of a state technology and memory interface there. Now, in Chinese studies, we are talking, of course, about both of a history and a modern history of a unification of memory. Now, unification of memory is not a timeless enterprise, namely that memory, the one and only orthodox history, is always one of the particular given moment. That's a shared element in all socialist societies. You would have the same in the Soviet Union. I mean, you take, as an example, the Bolshaya Encyclopedia, you know, from 36, you know, the big Soviet encyclopedia, you know, well, you know, and then comes the big show trials, you know, and Trotsky is out, you know, and well, you know, then, you know, Borodin is out and so on and so forth. And then the subscribers to that encyclopedia get, as a matter of fact, because they couldn't reprint the entire thing, it was too expensive, so the subscribers get slips sent, you know, which they are supposed to glue with totally different entries, but on a similar alphabetical listing, to glue over the original one to somehow keep that in a helpless way up to date, you know. So that's part of memory administration, you know. And you have in the PRC, you get a constant habit in a way of standardizing history. The party makes decisions on history. So it's not just something where some historian says this or the other. No. The party makes some question on the history of our party, which always is also the history of of China. And these decisions by the party leadership then filter down to the last TV broadcast, school book, museum, you name it, you know. So this is a way of homogenizing things. And everybody of you who has taught students coming from the PRC will know that the kind of a historical bios, you know, the basic grit of their setup in their heads is very successfully informed by this endlessly reflected and reproduced kind of official history which they have grown up with, and to somehow alert them even to the fact that there is a lot of sort of odd ends in there which don't fit, is a very cumbersome and difficult process. And sometimes if that process is successful, they end up in no man's land because they just don't really know what to do now, you know, because somehow, if that is not what it is, you know, what is then what, you know, and then suddenly they get all confused and can't write their PhDs or whatever it is, you know, and sort of doodle around, a very complicated affair. So we have in the Chinese context there an effort to, as a matter of fact, homogenize memory to a rather strong extent. And you might remember that we had just 2 weeks ago this very nice controversy with Cambridge University Press when the Chinese propaganda department alerted them that on their website they offered, you know, a number of journal subjects, China Quarterly and a lot of books, you know, which are related to China in one way or the other. And the Chinese propaganda department, this is on the website which you can subscribe to. And there are some Chinese universities, a few of them only, which have subscribed to Cambridge University Press online offering. Right? Now, that's, you know, this is a place where Google is blocked, you know, where most of the other archival sources are not accessible. So suddenly you get through Cambridge University Press website, you know, if you're at Nanjing University or at Fudan University in Shanghai, you suddenly get access to a type of information which is not fitting the master narrative. And that's not good. So then the propaganda department writes the kind note to Cambridge University Press and says, would you please delete the following 1,300 articles and books, you know, from your online offering? And Cambridge University said, well, big market, we do it. And then you have a big sort of a hullabaloo among the scholars who protest when they hear about it. And Cambridge University Press then kindly reversed itself. But now, of course, they don't know what to do, in fact, you know, because somehow the next thing, we don't know how the Chinese propaganda department is going to react to that. But the likelihood is that they're going to say, well, tough luck, you know, your possibility of selling your online access in China is herewith cancelled. We haven't heard that yet, you know, but I mean, you get this kind of a little notice every day, and the specific form that takes is that the propaganda department is sending down something like, well, you know, every day to various internet providers and so on, sending something like 20 to 30 notices a day, what they are supposed to delete, what they are supposed to play low, no headlines with it, what they are supposed to stick only with the official narrative from the Xinhua News Agency and so on and forth. So you have a kind of a micro guidance, and that also is not just a negative one, it comes with a positive one. Namely, they have a wonderful army of the five centers, they are called, you know, namely people who get per web page note which is agreeing with the government line, they get a minimal payment there, you know, and these are something like the level of perhaps 2 million people, you know, who will then, you know, some public discussion comes up, you know, and then you have, you know, a lot of people who earn their little penny, you know, by touting, you know, or, you know, with their own words, you know, not just verbatim quoting something, that this is, you know, unpatriotic and unacceptable and so on and so forth. So you have a complex situation there. So we had I give you a simple example of how we somehow operate on that. So the example is that there is in the Nanfang Zhoumo, that's the Nanfang Renwu, that's a kind of little journal coming up in Canton, a part of a big newspaper system, which is the Southern Weekend and the Southern Daily. So this is Southern Personalities. And Southern Personalities published something in 2004, article on 100 public intellectuals in China, Chinese public intellectuals. Now, I saw that on the internet, as a matter of fact, that somebody alerted me to it, you know, and I said, oh, that's going to be a problem. Because evidently, public intellectuals are different from the party. They might be party members, but they are not, they don't have their status as public intellectuals because they are speaking for the party. They are speaking for themselves. So my suspicion was, you know, we're going to have a big problem there. So I asked two of our student helpers to sit down, and but literally within minutes, you know, and download everything written by and about these 100 public intellectuals they could lay their hands on. Now, which was ended up being a huge a trove of files, you know, something they downloaded, something like nearly 2,000 articles by these people, you know, and then another 2,000, 3,000 about them, and so on and so forth, the discussion about them. So, and well, in this case, I must proudly say, you know, my understanding of the dynamics of the political process in China turned out to be 100% accurate. You know, the propaganda department was slower than we were. So something like 10 days after the article was out, you know, the propaganda department, number one, this periodical is being withdrawn from circulation. Number two, the names of these 100 personalities are deleted from the Chinese internet, which has a nice sort of a firewall around itself, and all their writings are taken down from the Chinese internet, right? So that's just, so suddenly, you know, we were the depository of China's, one small fragment of China's memory, you know? So that, as a matter of fact, is the idea which we have been operating with. Now, this library in Heidelberg, which has done this work, was when I came there in 87, was what at that time, I must confess, in with apologies to the people who had built it up, you know, in my negotiations with the president of the university, I told him what he has there is something like a sausage parlor of a library, you know, and that didn't go down well with my predecessor and people who had been working a lot, you know, but it was a library in Chinese studies terms, which was, I mean, worse, well, it could not really be worse, but something on a level with the library, sorry for being impolite, the Chinese studies holdings at Boston University, which has, as a matter of fact, the big Asian studies department, you know, and an inexisting Asian studies original language library, you know, which is really amazing. You know, it's a big, famous university. And, you know, you look there, you know, and says, you know, the Mugar does not have Chinese language books. They don't even have somebody who can read the title of a Chinese language book. Anyway, so. So that was, of course, in a way, a clean slate. You know, we had just our 20,000 little books there. That's very nice. And we had a little bit of money, and eventually we got some foundation money, and I got some big prize from some $2 million. You know, let's put that in there. So that was all very pleasant. Anyway, we started building that up and decided, okay, why don't we build it up, you know, without respect for the standard education of the librarians. Now, I apologize for the librarians who are here and who have much competence and much work on that, but there are certain rules among librarians' education, which, as a matter of fact, I think are not really contributive. If you want to develop an actual hybrid library, you have to disregard them. Now, what are these rules? First rule is, a library is is a book, you know, so a library does not collect films or musical scores or photographs. That's what a library do. Other people do that, and if they don't, that's their problem, you know. Now, the musical library says, of course, we don't read Chinese, we don't collect Chinese music. The film library says we don't collect no Chinese, we don't own Chinese films. So this is a no-brainer, you know, but so that's the first thing. The second thing is that they basically assume that there are types of books which an academic library does not collect. The standard types are two, namely school books, and the number two is books which are, distributed at church doors or temple, which doesn't cost anything, books which you cannot buy at a bookseller. You know, you don't buy those, you know. Now, if you just close your eyes and think about anybody who has a library with the school books of any country of the last 150 years, that will, of course, allow you to reproduce in rather great accuracy, you know, the type of nation-state education, you know, and the kind of values and so on and so forth, you know. Well, you know, you look around, you know, Harvard University has basically no school books, you know, the Widener Library, and probably Boston University doesn't have it either, you know, because it's just not done, you know. And the same is true if you look at these church pamphlets or similar things like that, you know, they, of course, are a record of value and value changed to a substantial degree. And so you go to local temples here and there and pick up these things, you know, and suddenly you see, woof, you know, I'm able to talk about things which on regular things you can't, please.
Oh, 2 minutes.
Oh, okay, yes. So, well, let's go into spend the last 2 minutes on the digital archive there. So what we basically have been doing is to harvest those elements which we considered have been unstable in terms of preservation of relevant memory. That means there is also a selection in there. Now, that does not only include people who make the public intellectuals I've been mentioning, but that includes also important internal documents which are not publicly accessible and might be disappearing. That includes records of party leaders which have not been published in China but have been published outside. That includes blogs. That includes blogs by dissidents inside and outside of China, blogs by disgraced party leaders, you know, and so on and so forth. So we have basically put together, you know, a very vast amount that's now together something like 5.5 million files, you know, with this type of record, which in terms of search, we have still have a large problem, because what we would need is a multilingual search that is able, with a single search question, try to go through different language types of records, you know, Chinese, Japanese, English, German, French, you name it, you know. And that, as a matter of fact, machinery is not yet available. So at the present moment, we only operate with the rather clumsy keywords from the Library of Congress system, which for this type of Chinese problem are, I mean, inadequate to a level which is, you know, very high level, you know, that is, you know, so it doesn't do very much, so you have to constantly supplement into subheadings there, something like that. And have, in order to prevent the problem getting into legal system, because we have the lawyers, of course, breathing down our neck, like you all have, we have put all that by necessity behind a kind of a fair use wall, which is a password wall. Namely, people who want to use it and access it have to apply for a password and shortly mention what they are doing that for, and that sign that they will not use it for commercial purposes, da-da-da, and then they get access to this entire pile. And this includes now basically records which only exist as online documents. It includes records which do exist as printed records, but which are inaccessible in large parts of the world or anywhere else. You know, there are lots of things which I have managed to buy here and there, which nobody else has. So we have digitized them, put them in there. That includes journals, books, and so on and so forth, right? It includes a huge set of something like 3,000 Chinese films. With the literature around it, it includes a huge amount of newspapers, you know, which we have digitized ourselves or bought digitized for, and it includes a huge music library, right? So we have, as a matter of fact, something like 4,000 records. That is both the notes, the tonal recordings, you know, and whatever reviews and so on have with it, you know. So this is a kind of a hybrid library, you know, where you can move, as a matter of fact, from the notion of a political scientist who never reads a novel, you know, but as a matter of fact, in China, novels are a key point of discussing politics, you know, to a literature person who has no idea about the Politburo, you know, to somebody who is dealing with the economy and has no idea about movies, you know, so you can basically force people, you know, to jump out of their kind of nation state and field limits there, you know, and as a matter of fact, integrate these different things. They are doing that sometimes, but it's a very tedious process, and it might, as we all know from the structure of scientific revolutions, take a generational death, you know, to move to the next generation, which will, for whom this practice will become completely normal. But at the present moment, I must say, this has been all done with minimal financing, so we are not very proud on that point. But let me finish with one sentence. One thing has happened is that our original idea was to create a flat Earth for the lots of small pizza parlor library, Chinese studies libraries in Germany, namely that you would, even in a miserable library, would be able to do high quality research by having access to a wide variety of high quality sources. Now the problem is, with all the money we had, which was relatively speaking a lot, you know, in German terms, you know, in American terms, nothing, but we could not manage that. We could not buy national licenses, you know, for big databases, you know, there was no way to do that. But happily enough, you know, and somehow I was somehow in a way involved in that, doesn't really matter, the Berlin State Library, you know, which was one of these old flagships, you know, way behind times, you know, doing buying books and doing this all very orthodox things, they hired somebody who, as a matter of fact, the world is moving on, you know, and this fellow has single-handedly built what is now by far the best digital library, you know, in Chinese studies and Indian studies and Korean studies and Japanese studies anywhere in the world. I mean, I sit at Harvard over here on the other side of the river. What do I use? I don't use the Harvard access there. I use the Berlin access because the quality is much better. You know, it's very simple. You know, it's broader, it's better, and it's a national license. Namely, from every stupid little pizza parlor in Germany, you can get in there for free, you know, and get access to the stuff. So that was one part. It's not the digital access part, which is more a hunting library. This is more the officially buyable, purchasable things there. But, you know, it was a very helpful thing, and I hope it will contribute to the improvement of scholarship worldwide. And now I have a lot of friends from all over the world who ask me, could we be friends? Do you become associate at your institute so we can get some kind of access to there? So I'm feeling very proud of that. Thank you very much for that.